You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Migration is not what it's cracked up to be.
Multiculturalism has become more of a cultural phenomenon. We're the others, you know, we're the ones that dress up in funny costumes, have occasional festivals, but we're not seen as politicized agents in a society.
È il momento di spostare l'attenzione dalle promesse istituzionali all'organizzazione popolare.
Buonasera a tutte e tutti e buon anno. Happy New Year to all. You're listening to Radio Filef on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, and streaming on 3cr.org.au and the Community Radio Plus app. The team at Radio Filef are taking a break over summer and will be bringing you a series of summer special programs. Tonight is our third summer special program, and we'll be listening to an interview I did with Tony Gusali. The second part of this interview will be broadcast next week. Listeners will remember that I met Tony when I attended the Francesco Fantin Memorial in Murchison on the 9th of November this year. Tony approached us at the memorial to tell us about his research on the Italian men who died in industrial accidents working on the construction of the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme. The Snowy scheme took 25 years to complete, from 1949 to 1974, and is perhaps the most iconic and most significant public infrastructure project undertaken in Australian history. Over 100,000 workers were employed in its construction, and at least 65% were migrant workers from over 30 countries. 121 men were officially declared to have died in industrial accidents during its construction. 27 of these men were Italian migrant workers. Tony is the nephew of one of these men, Antonio Gusali, who died in the worst multi-fatality accident on the scheme on the 16th of April 1958. In that accident, four young Italian men lost their lives. Tony's research has also found that another two Italian men died in accidents in the early years of the scheme while employed by the New South Wales Department of Public Works. Tony has conducted extensive research about each of these 29 men, including obtaining migration records and coronial inquests, in order to tell the broader collective story of these post-war migrant workers. Tony's research has provided him with meaningful personal insight and details about his uncle's migration to Australia and his time here. Tony's mission and goal now is to establish contact with the contemporary relatives of each of these men and to provide them with the archive records he has obtained and encourage them to contribute to the telling of their collective story. Tony has a further goal with his research, which is to encourage interested stakeholders to contribute to commemorating not just the Italian men, but all those who died working on the scheme. When Tony told me about his research, I was instantly interested. I share Tony's passion for this kind of personal and people's history. The particular aspects of personal and family stories such as these help us understand more broadly our collective history and the history of labour and migration to Australia. I also have a personal interest in this, as my uncle also worked on the Snowy scheme for a number of years. It was the entry point for him in migrating to Australia. There would also be many more people who share this and can relate to this history. I believe this is an important story to be told, especially given that there are aspects of it which appear to have been forgotten. Thanks to Tony, the valuable stories of these men can be told and remembered. We will be sharing the names and details, including photos of the 29 Italian men, along with Tony's contact details in our show notes, and encourage any listeners who may know these men, be related to these men, or have a connection to the scheme to reach out. I give a warning that this interview includes descriptions of workplace accidents, injuries and deaths, which may be difficult for some listeners. So, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Buonasera.
Buonasera. So just, I guess, before we get into it, could you tell us a bit about yourself, your family history?
Okay. So my father migrated from Castellieri in Italy in 1952. Castellieri is a small town near the larger town of Sora, in the province of Frosinone, in an area that's close to the border with Abruzzo and Molise, and it's not far from the World War II Gustav Line area, Monte Cassino. People may have heard of the Battle of Monte Cassino. So that's where my family comes from. My mother is from the nearby town of Sora, the larger town. So my father migrated in 1952. He was the first of his family to do so. I discovered only a couple of years ago in research that rather than going to the Bongila or Bonagila, as others pronounce it, a migrant camp in Wodonga, as a lot of the assisted migrants did, he ended up in a camp in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, which was called Greta, that I'd never heard of. And within a few months, he found employment on the Snowy scheme. He remained there for a period of time. So I was born in Cooma because of my father ending up working on the Snowy scheme. But when I was a couple of years old, my father, my mum and my three siblings, we all relocated to where I'm now living, which is in Shepparton in northern Victoria. We lived there for a couple of years, and then my father decided to take us all back to Italy, back to Saida, where we lived for 3 years. My father then had an industrial accident of his own, and he died of complications. And then my mother decided to bring us back here, where we've been since 1967. We've all been in the Shepparton area.
What work was your father doing?
He was building homes. He got inspired from what he'd learnt in Australia. So what I've learnt is that in the early 1960s, for example, in Shepparton, there was some growth, and the Italians had building skills that weren't common, because what was common, I guess, at the time, as far as I know, is a lot of carpentry work. So houses on stumps with timber floors, timber framing and weatherboards, whereas the Italians had the masonry skills, concrete, bricklaying, stonework, etc. They were able to participate in construction with those skills. And I guess my father probably had the idea that he'd learnt a lot here. He might have acquired a little bit of capital, and that was an opportunity to go back to Italy. And as it turned out, he was starting to be successful in his building, because the style of homes and finishing that he was doing was not common in Italy. But one day, I think the practice used to be that they would dig a pit and have water and a certain powder chemical product, a lime of some sort, and the chemical reaction after a period of time, they would lay that as a waterproofing or dampproofing layer in the masonry and then work from there. And he fell into this pit and he was chemically burnt. And then within 7 days of that accident happening, I'm told that he contracted pneumonia through what's anecdotally said to be not the best of care. And then he died. And I have actually, when I was in Italy a few years ago, I drove and stopped by the hospital that I have a vague memory of, and without getting too emotional about it, I have this memory of being in the hospital room when I was 8 years old, and me and my siblings and my mum were with my father. And what I understand is that my mum had got called to the hospital, so you better come because it's not going well.
Yeah.
So I've had this vague recollection of being there, and it's only in more recent times that I've got my own family that I've thought, geez, you know, like, he was 33 years old. He must have known he was going to die, and he's got his wife and four kids there on the bed, you know, and he's powerless to do what he aspired to do. So we came back here, and we've lived our lives, and I'm often marvelling that it's, 60 years nearly since he died, and the four of us kids still alive and well, and my mum's now in aged care, but she's lived. And amazingly, the Italian government's managed to pay my mum a pension from his insurance for 60-plus years.
Right, okay. Did he come on the assisted passage scheme? Right,
yes,
okay. So that meant he had to work for 2 years
at
the discretion of the government?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is that how he got to the Snowy River scheme?
Yes. So although I don't know the specifics yet, when he arrived at the Greta migrant camp, typically what I understand happens is they orientate you a bit. They do a little bit on the ship as they're coming in, but basically they sit you there and say, okay, you're in Australia now. Here are some basics, some language stuff. And then these camps, the one that I'm most familiar is the Bongila camp, because that's still, there's structures there and you can wander inside.
Yeah, he was meant to go there, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah. So I've only just recently learnt some updates on this by finding some newspaper articles. So my father departed Italy at the beginning of July 1952. And on the document, the destination was Melbourne, then it would have been Bongila. as the ship was in transit, on the 19th of July 1952, a protest erupted in Bongilla. It's called a riot in some of the literature, but I think a lot of it was the Italians who were there had been there for an extended period of time compared to their expectations. They weren't getting employment because there was an economic recession happening in Australia in 1952. So the government's arrangement with Italy struck in, I think it was about July 1951, for this assisted passage arrangement, which they had been doing with various countries. I suppose they had forecast perhaps what the circumstances might be or the number of people they wanted. But the reality was that as these thousands of people were arriving and being sent to their various camps, particularly the Bongilla one, they weren't being able to leave quickly enough. And you had things like single men were put in a certain section, segregated from families. There are individuals who were there, if I've got the name right, Giovanni Sgro.
Yeah.
Was physically there.
And he was a leader of one of this protest.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he was there and he's written about it. So you have those accounts.
I'll just say he was one of the founders of PhilF Melbourne.
Yes, I've learnt that. So people can read various accounts of what happened. But from what I understand, there was just pent-up frustration. Although the documents very clearly state that the Australian government did not guarantee them work, and they signed these documents and they were written in Italian and English, I think that what was sold to them from Italy, depending on who the recruiters were, probably raised their expectations, and these young men probably had their own expectations and they possibly didn't absorb or perhaps even read in detail what they signed, right?
I think they had, did they have fees to pay as well whilst in the camp?
Yes. So the arrangement, as I understand it, was the two governments subsidised the cost of coming here. The Australian government didn't require any repayment of funds, but it required them to agree to work for a period of 2 years wherever they were assigned or risk losing their rights and status. The Italian side required them to repay a monthly amount, which went to some Italian agency, I guess a government-related agency. And so these men were required to, on a monthly basis for, I guess, the 2 years, to make a payment. While they were here, they had expenses through being at the camp. They received a very small payment from a government, but not enough to offset their costs. So that they obviously were in this position where they were feeling unfulfilled, disappointed, embarrassed, you know, perhaps in terms of what they might have told their families and how they felt about themselves. And so that caused this protest. So as my father's ship was approaching Fremantle, they were redirected, although the ship stopped in Melbourne to offload whoever legitimately needed to get off there. Something like 900 passengers ended up in Sydney, and the assisted migration ones went to this greeter camp. And there are newspaper articles that talk about, you know, a whole lot of Italians coming at short notice from Sydney to greeter. What I've recently read is that the Australian government was becoming concerned over the circumstances at Bongilla, so that prior to the protest on the 19th, they had already determined that this ship would no longer go to Bongilla, and they had given notice to greeter to get organised. And there's a newspaper article I found dated around the 14th of July, 5 days before the riot. So yes, it appears that it was not panic. You know, there's this protest happening, let's reroute the ship. That concern started a few days or weeks earlier. But nevertheless, that's what happened to that ship, which arrived in Sydney on the 1st of August 1952. But then I've got records of ships arriving in Melbourne on the 2nd of August, and those assisted passage men went to Bongilla. So there was something happening in that period of July where the government was adjusting where people go. And Bongilla has retained its records of who was there. You can search them. Whereas greeter camp had no records kept that remain. So I can't search I don't have a database that I can search for Greta, but I've been able to recreate some things. So one of the things that I asked the National Archives is, are there records of employment with the Snowy Scheme for Antonio Guzzelli, my uncle, and Michele Guzzelli? And the answer was not for Antonio, but yes, for Michele. That was a surprise. I didn't know that my father was actually employed for a period. So I was able then to request his card. And I now know that after arriving on the 1st of August, that by late November, he was employed by the Snowy Scheme. So I've got photos in my mum's album, some of which probably my father may have sent to my mum while she was still in Italy, where he's working on locations of the Snowy Scheme, which I haven't been able to fully determine exactly where they are. And I've got a couple of photos that may be work not on the scheme, because the sorts of things that the migrants of that period were being sent to do was cane cutting in Queensland, which was seasonal, chopping wood, cutting wood for fuel was another. And I've read another migrant's story who survived of that period, where he said, for example, he got sent to woodcutting in Cowra, where the site of the prisoner of war camp happens to be. And because they didn't like the conditions, the word among the group was, well, there's work available now on the Snowy Scheme. And some people then looked for work there. So my father may have been part of that network where he'd heard of the work. But nevertheless, I do know that from December 1953, he was working on the scheme. And then he, at various points, I know where he was working based on the documents.
Right. Do you know what type of work he was doing?
So he was first mentioned as a bricklayer, an assistant bricklayer in the first one. There was another term used in one of the documents, Packerman, I think, or something like that. Batterman, B-A-T-T, which I still haven't determined what that job is.
Il nostro treno lascia la stazione, partiamo in tanti per necessità, siamo i soldati dell'emigrazione e disarmati andiamo a lavorare, e disarmati andiamo a lavorare. Per una vita o per una stagione andiamo a Londra, a Parigi o in Canada. Ma nelle nostre valigie di cartone c'è tanta fame e buona volontà.
C'è tanta fame e buona volontà.
Qui il cielo è grigio anche il padrone. Grigia è la lingua e la mentalità. Guardando noi si parla di invasione. Noi siamo qui soltanto a faticare.
Noi siamo qui soltanto a faticare.
Com'è lontano il nostro meridione, ogni giornata qui è un'eternità. Ma basterà il profumo di un limone a ricordarci che non durerà.
Ma basterà il profumo di un limone a ricordarci che non durerà.
Dove passiamo mattone, vengono su le dighe le città. Dove passiamo arriva una canzone, un po' d'amore e di felicità.
Dove passiamo arriva una canzone, un po' d'amore e di felicità.
Se uno di noi per soldi o per passione ha un conto aperto con la società.
The song is Gli Emigranti by Antonio, Giorgio e Daniela from their album Le Canzoni degli Emigranti, Volume 2. And you're listening to Radio Filef on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. This is our third summer special program, and we're listening to part one of an interview I did with Tony Guselli about his research on the Italian men who died in industrial accidents working on the construction of the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme.
E verso il sole ognuno se ne va.
La neve, il freddo, il fumo ed il carbone. E verso il sole.
I just want to talk a little bit about, or ask you about, the nature of the work that the Italians were doing, Or firstly, more generally, the kind of work that was involved with the Snowy Scheme. So the Snowy Scheme is the largest infrastructure project in Australian history, right? It's 16 dams, 12 tunnels, 7 power stations and 2 pumping stations.
I think it would still remain as over the geographic area, you know, probably the largest.
And 25 years.
Mm.
So I've seen what's involved now with the tunnelling project in the city for the Metro Tunnel, and what was it like in the 50s and 60s, and dam construction, and particularly what were the Italians known for, or what were they doing there?
This is not something that I've studied in deep detail, but what I have picked up in my readings is at the beginning there was such an urgency to start the scheme so that it couldn't be politically stopped that it was literally picks and shovels, human labour and picks and shovels. And that's because at the beginning, Australia didn't have neither the labour nor the equipment for this sort of work. It progressively brought in overseas contracting for that reason. It was able to purchase equipment, earth-moving equipment, etc. So to the extent that I understand, so there was dam construction. So that involved, obviously, above-ground work with heavy earth-moving equipment, blasting, things like that. The tunnel working was obviously exploding, drilling and dynamiting and taking the spoils out. So a lot of the Italians worked in teams doing this. In Italian teams.
In the tunnelling section.
In the tunnelling. Yeah. So that some of the tunnelling was one of the contractors developed this technique where they had 2 or 3 levels. It was called a jumbo. So men would operate at different heights to each other so they could, you know, do the tunnel face. This is what's interesting compared to the current tunnel boring machines, right? So back then, jackhammers to drill holes, place explosives in the holes, have an explosion. Some men died because they were struck by the rocks. They would prepare each section, blast, like move back, blast, then send in equipment on a railroad track to take out the demolished amount. They would have to check that it was safe. So they would try and loosen rocks from above for the reason that it didn't fall on people, but people actually died because ultimately loose rocks fell on them or rocks from the carriages of the trains that were taking it out fell on them, or they got struck by a locomotive, you know, the equipment. Some died because when they were jackhammering, a residue from a previous unexploded element went off. So Ernesto Vecchiato, from memory, one of the men, he died from that, just sort of shrapnel from that. Driving equipment, trucks, large excavators rolling over and killing the driver. One Italian, from memory, was involved in relocating homes from old Adaminibi to new Adaminibi, and I think the truck struck some soft ground and overturned, and he was killed as it was overturned. Falls from heights, so my uncles and the other 3 men. One Italian and others were involved in an accident where concrete being poured down a very long chute into a shaft blocked because there was some concrete that had hardened and it blocked, so that there was so much backup cement that it exceeded the capacity of the pipes, and so they dropped on them. One person in that story was encased up to a certain level of his legs. This is a bit gory, but I think they had to amputate his legs to get the rest of him out. He was not an Italian, that man, from memory. I recommend people find online Fergus Robinson's occupational health and safety analysis of performance on the Snowy Mountain Scheme, dated around 1997. Yeah. It's got an excellent overview of the Snowy Scheme, and then chapter by chapter on different aspects. One Italian was cleaning, hosing down a subterranean, let's say, space, and for some reason or other slipped and fell down a shaft, and that's the only, he was an employee of the Snowy Scheme, and I've seen a letter from the commissioner of the senior role, I can't remember now, Bill Hudson, wrote to his parents saying, we're notifying you, and if there's anything we can do to assist, you know, we will.
Okay.
So Fergus's book has in detail the types of activities that people died. So the Italians were typically working with their skill set. Some were doing the high wire transmission line work, helping sort that out. And they were literally up in the air working. Some were in the tunnels, some were above ground, you know, driving vehicles and things like mm-hmm. that.
Was it the nature of the work that the Italians took on, that it was more dangerous than others? Was there a different approach
From what I've heard, for example, Australian labour who had choices didn't choose to do some of that work because of either the conditions. Well, and they would have been living in camps. They would have been working in extreme climate. And then there was risk. Some workers I've heard, once they get a sense of the risk, they might have witnessed something. Then they said, no, I'm not doing this anymore. Or if they had a family, the wife would say, look, I don't want you going back to that sort of work. So there were circumstances like that. But, you know, the judgment of, if I do this work and I get paid well and I get overtime, you know, I'm going to be able to set myself up. I'm only going to do this for X period and then I get to buy a home, etc.
So your father then was working here for some years and was able to sponsor your uncle?
Yes. So my father was the firstborn of the family. There was 7 siblings. Antonio was the next oldest, 2 years younger than my father. So in 1954, my father sponsored Antonio to arrive. Unlike my father, he didn't need assisted passage. Mm-hmm. So his destination was directly to Cuma. And then him and my father resided together, possibly in, like, let's call them share houses or things like that for a short period.
Yeah.
But this is another interesting observation now, is that, so my father arriving in 1954, by 1955, he'd purchased a vacant land in Cuma and started constructing a small dwelling. So, you know, can someone come to Australia now with nothing and within a few years buy a block of land? That was
very different.
That was the reality then, right? Mm. So he built a very modest little structure that I think was an enclosure with wall and a roof. And my uncle helped. They both worked together. They had the skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later, my other uncle was sponsored across. Mm-hmm. And when he arrived, they were living in I think they managed to enclose one room under this roofed walled area.
Right. Yeah.
And that's where they lived. And I've told stories of some other Italians would come and visit because one of my uncles could cook spaghetti that tasted good.
Mm.
And these men weren't getting Italian style food typically in where they were working, right? But they had to put up with minimal shelter to enjoy the company.
Yeah.
So that's 1956. My second uncle has come here. So my father's working on the scheme with the Snowy Authority and then with various contractors. Mm. And ultimately, I think he's working, let's say, as a subcontractor to perhaps a building company, a local building company. Mm-hmm. Most of the period was working on Snowy projects, but I think in between, depending on the projects waxing and waning, mm-hmm. he did other work. My uncle Antonio worked probably in the domestic building trade. We're doing bricklaying and various masonry type work and concrete. And my other uncle, he trained as a shoemaker. So he found work in Cuma as a shoemaker. He didn't work on the scheme, to the best of my knowledge.
Sole alla valle, sole alla collina, per le campagne non c'è più nessuno. Incallite ormai senza speranza. Addio, addio, amore. Io vado via, amara terra mia, amara e bella. Fra gli uliveti è nata già la luna, un bimbo piange all'alta un seno magro. Addio.
This song is called Amare Terra Mia by Domenico Modugno. You're listening to Radio Filef on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. This is our third summer special program, and we're listening to part one of an interview I did with Tony Guselli about his research on the Italian men who died in industrial accidents working on the construction of the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme.
In 1958, there's a couple of stories in my family that I haven't yet been able to absolutely prove. But so my father had decided he wanted to marry, and some of the Italians living around the area married Australian women. So my father, for reasons I don't fully know, but I can understand, he asked if he could find an Italian bride. So he asked my uncle, Don, who was at that time still in Italy, if they could find a suitable young lady. And through a connection, my uncle there was friends with a cousin of my mum, and they mentioned my mum. So the two were given information about each other, and my mum, who was only 16 or something at the time, agreed that she liked the idea of a proxy marriage, which it would have been.
So and it was pretty common.
It was common back then, yes, right? And then ultimately, I mean, you think, I've got a daughter. If my daughter at 16 has said, I'm considering the prospect of marrying someone I've never met who's, you know, half a world away. I can't say I'd be very excited, but that's what my mum did. And so in hindsight, I know at that age she had no idea what all that would mean. But I can understand someone being excited at this prospect and saying, well, this is my life here. This is what's being offered to me. Yeah, certainly I'll give it a go. So they were officially married with my grandfather standing in for my father as the proxy. I think it was late 1956 that the marriage happened. I believe the practice at the time was when a woman marries, then she goes to live with the husband's family, which my mum did, although the husband wasn't there, right? And then what I've learnt is my father had expected that mum could come out promptly, but it took 15 or 16 months before mum could get here. And my father was writing to the immigration department saying, what's going on, you know? Like, and so they put mum through the typical requirement of migrant selection, and I've got the documents, where she had to get health checks and all the rest. So although they were married, that didn't guarantee her being able to come here. She had to meet criteria. Which took quite a while. So by April 1958, mum had gotten the paperwork and was able to get on the ship and come here. So then my father, I believe, needed to make arrangements to go and collect her in Sydney and drive from Cooma to Sydney to collect her.
Yeah.
So the story is that he needed to take time off work to do that, and he asked whether his younger brother, Antonio, could work the shift for him so that they didn't lose that sort of employment arrangement without having to do too much of the HR type of process. So irregardless of how it happened, Antonio went from working outside of the Snowy Scheme to working for a French consortium in an area called the Tumut One project, where an underground power station was being constructed, and they resided in a workers' camp called Kenny's Knob near Cabramurra, which is the highest town in Australia. So it was high country, cold in the winter, etc. Within 2 weeks of starting work, my uncle's accident occurred. My mum arrived in Australia, I think, on the 6th of April. And on the 16th of April, my uncle's accident occurred. So it was a great welcome to Australia for my mum. Yeah. I still don't fully know to what extent she got to know this uncle, but her circumstances after a couple of weeks here of meeting her husband for the first time, moving into the little residence that he'd prepared for her in Cooma, and then having the death occur, which are things that, again, I've only recently have become more apparent to me on reflection. But although we've heard some aspects of this story in the past, it, I just didn't really connect with it. So the story with my uncle then is they were working in, so the task of this team, which was on shift work, was there was a 360 meter high shaft for a lift to get from the top of the surface of the high level down to the underground power station. And they lined this shaft with heavy concrete pipes all the way up the 360 meters, and then they would install the lifts inside later. And I believe I've read that it was the longest single drop lift in the world at that time. So on the 16th of April, which I believe is a Monday at 2 p.m., this team had reached about the 75% mark of this shaft. And each shift worked, I think, roughly 8 hours. They were close to the end of the shift and they decided to do one more lift. And there was, I think, a little bit of competition between the groups. How many lifts do you do in a day? They might have been key to set a bit of a record. So there was a platform that the men stood on to guide the pipes being lowered in the lift and to help avoid the pipe getting too close to the perimeter, you know, just to ease it to go down. It would then lock in to the below one, and then that would be repeated for each element. So on this particular day, the winch that was being used, and I've got photos from the archives of what that area looked like, the winch failed. The brake that might have been used to arrest the fall didn't work. The operator didn't have time to react quickly. So the platform with the pipe and the men fell. And my understanding is some aspects of it, including the men fell all the way to the bottom 360 meters below, and they perished instantly. I've done a quick calculation that it might have been 8 or 9 seconds at gravity to fall, right? So they would have had some obvious awareness of what was happening, but it happened relatively quickly. There were four young Italians working on that shift. There was typically, I think, ethnic groups did certain works together.
Yeah.
The language was an issue, so they could communicate among themselves. I don't know if all of the other shifts were Italian, but this particular shift was. So Michele Di Salvio, Benito Pizzol, Giuseppe Rugolo, and because I want to pay respect to these men, and Antonio Guzzelli, all died in that accident. It was the worst multiple fatality accident of the whole scheme. There were a number of other multiple fatality accidents, but this one had four young men in one event. And there were other accidents where larger numbers were involved and there were injuries, but in terms of single accident with multiple fatalities, this was the worst. There was an inquest subsequently, as there was for all of the deaths, and sorry, this reminds me of a story. So this is where it started for me. Around 3 years ago, I was at home. I don't know why, but I just had the instinct to search for my uncle's name on the web. So I'm named after him, but I was named Tony on my birth certificate. He's Antonio. And I got a result quite quickly, which mentioned an inquest report. I had read about inquests, obviously, in the books that I'd read about the snowy skiing, but I'd never thought that I could access an inquest report. I didn't know how you could do that. But this result seemed to have a link that I could follow up. So I did. And it turned out to be the New South Wales archives that has had a lot of the older snowy mountain skiing documents and the court reporting handed over to it. So I was able to order the inquest document. And to my surprise, it was about 70 pages of documents. So that was for each of the men. There was technical, some reports, mechanical type of analysis, the police reports, the coroner's, you know, evidence and so forth for the coronial inquiry, but even including photos of the equipment. And the inquest stated that, for example, the equipment should have been inspected regularly, but it turned out that the inspections were fairly cursory. There was dust and grease on it, so that prevented the inspector seeing the actual surface of the material. And so what had happened was that the winch had been acquired by the French company, I believe from Tasmania, and repurposed. It had some sort of mechanical problem and someone had welded the equipment to repair it. But the material that the winch was made from was not repairable by welding. So that was that weld that failed. Yet the inquest did not find any fault on the employer's side. It was ruled accidental death, as a lot of the others were.
Yeah, well.
So people who have written about the story, like Siobhan McHugh, mentions this accident in her book. Fergus Robinson, I think, mentions it as one of the case studies. So people who've looked at this have questioned why something like that was not deemed to be maybe not negligent, but at least, you know, in that direction.
I think that was the case with a lot of the accidents, if not most of them, maybe all of them, that it was deemed accidental when probably by today's standards, this would be considered negligence and probably even industrial manslaughter.
Yes, so I'm careful that I don't want to rewrite history, right? That's what happened. And they were different times, but one of the justifications that's put out is, well, this is what it was like back then, right? This was the nature of work and it was dangerous work.
Yeah, it just makes me think and want to ask, it's something I read in Robinson's book, that the standards had changed so much by the time he was doing his research, which I think was about 20 years ago, from the 1950s. And it's not as if there wasn't safety measures in place or an understanding of it. It was just whether, as well as there being standards, were they put into practice. There was a bit of a gung-ho nature on the part of some of the contractors. But there was also just an acceptance that this work was inherently dangerous and that this was part of the work, basically.
Yes. Well, so this touches on something that's, you know, that's my cause. And perhaps we'll get onto that later in more detail. But so what I've discovered through looking at this particular accident in the beginning and now that I'm looking at the 29 Italians, and I'd like to look at 121 more broadly, but in terms of manageable work, I'm looking at the Italians, was that this was the circumstances of their work. They were, by the nature of their migration circumstances, you know, needing to work, and they were willing to work in an opportunity that gave them a higher income. You know, you got to give them agency. They agreed to do this. They could have said no. They may not have fully understood the risks they were taking, but they were there voluntarily, let's say. But as per Robinson's book, the culture of safety differed from the Snowy scheme itself, so Snowy Authority and its direct employees, to the contractors. And some contractors were deemed much more gung-ho than others, is what's been written about. But when these men died, the process at the time was there was urgency about this work continuing. The Snowy scheme, which we haven't talked about any history of it, which we can if we want. There was obviously politics around the scheme from the beginning. So the Snowy Authority was very proactive about publicity and it did a lot to try and create as favourable an image of the scheme as possible because it needed to. So politically, it was a difficult project that was initiated in a political environment that didn't have bipartisan support in the beginning and had constitutional issues as well, because it was created under a federal legislation to overcome the fact that two states had buy-in on aspects like, for example, the Snowy River was involved, or the tributaries of waterways that were coming from New South Wales but emanating through Victoria, for example. So it was a federal arrangement, a federal agency that was created. So I've looked at the annual reports of the authority, particularly like 1958-59 report, and there was no requirement to or no effort in reporting injuries and deaths in those reports, right? So that was the requirements of the day. They weren't obliged by any rule to do that. So they didn't talk about industrial things very much, but ironically, in the reporting year of these deaths, of which there were others in that year, the authority spoke about the death of one of their own executives, I think, like a senior manager.
Right.
But it didn't have any need to report on other deaths. Mm. Right? So what happened, I'm told, and I've read about, is that when an accident like this happened, obviously the men, any men involved, especially if it was tunnelling work and others, they would stop work.
Mm.
There would be some investigations and so forth. It could have been dangerous continuing, especially in the tunnels. So then the people connected closely to the individual co-workers would want to grieve. In my uncle's case, the accident happened on a Monday afternoon. The funeral was held on the Wednesday morning. My father and other uncle were there at the time. They were not involved, as far as I know, in making any arrangements that this would have been done by the employer. The employer would have paid for the funeral, and that was so that they could get the men back to work quickly because there was urgency about the work. So in these four men's case, my uncle was buried in the Cooma Cemetery. Another one I subsequently found was buried in the Wonthaggi Cemetery because he had relatives in Wonthaggi, Victoria. And the other two were actually repatriated to Italy. The remainder remained buried, mostly in Cooma, but some in other cemeteries. So for the majority of them, I'm told that the two that were repatriated to Italy, the cost of sending the coffins back to Italy was equivalent to buying a home in Sydney at the time, I've been told. Right? Oh, yeah. I can't understand the economics of that, but that's what I'm told. So for each of these men, the archives have a probate report because they died young and intestate, no will. So the trustee, the government trustee, had to determine their assets and I presume return a monetary value to their next of kin. So for each of them, I think all four, most of the 29 I've looked at, there's a probate document which lists their assets. And the confronting thing about that is these men had been working in Australia for different periods of time, working in what was deemed to be a good income, and they didn't have a lot of assets when they died. My uncle had an insurance arrangement for some reason. I don't fully know how that was about, maybe through his employment, but not all of them did.
All'estero mi trovo a lavorare. Cerco e spero di poter tornare laddove il mio paese e la mia mamma e da quel di che non rivedo più la nostalgia sempre m'assale tutte le sere che penso a te ti rivedo nel focolare che pensi e piangi sol per me non pensare più non piangere per me che ritorno al focolare accanto a te io ti voglio tanto bene da morire e non voglio mai vederti più soffrire non pensare più non piangere per me che ritorno al focolare accanto a te per amarti, per baciarti sempre più oh mamma, mamma, solo un sogno mio sei tu ti scriverò per consolarmi ancora e col pensiero scrivo e vedo te che accarezzi ancora i miei capelli come quel di che non ritorna più mi desto triste dal sogno mamma che non ti vedo più accanto a me però ti mando tutto il mio cuore e quanto bene voglio a te Non pensare più, non piangere per me, che ritorno al focolare accanto a te. Io ti voglio tanto bene da morire,
e non voglio mai vederti più soffrire. Non pensare più, non piangere per me, che ritorno al focolare accanto a te, per amarti, per baciarti sempre più. Oh mamma, mamma, solo un sogno mio sei tu. Oh mamma, mamma, solo un sogno mio sei tu.
That song was Nostalgico Emigrante by Franco Trincale, and you're listening to Radio Filef on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. This is our third summer special program, and we're listening to part one of an interview I did with Tony Cusali about his research on the Italian men who died in industrial accidents working on the construction of the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme.
So in the case of the Italians that were repatriated, Giuseppe Rugolo being one example, because I've spoken to his relatives, he came to Australia. He was the oldest of the four that died. He came to Australia, had a romantic interest in Italy. His expectation, he would come here for a while and then return to Italy and marry and set up. So instead, his body goes back to Italy in a coffin. His family incurred a cost in getting him back, which most likely would have exceeded the probate amount. And that's essentially part of the story that I've wanted to understand and communicate, is in the Cuma Cemetery, where my uncle is, he's actually got a traditional grave because my grandfather was a stonemason. So when my grandfather came here, he built a marble, you know, tomb.
Mm.
There are three other tombs that I know of the Italians have that are a fully formed tomb. But of all of the 16 in the Cuma Cemetery, the remainder started off with a very basic grave, let's say. Mm. A number of years later, an Italian priest arranged for a couple of Italian tradesmen to construct a concrete border, a plinth around each grave and a steel cross, plus the little headstone that was there from the beginning. So I've wondered, you know, how many of these graves have had a relative visit the grave and how many not.
Mm.
And there's one Italian, Pellegrini, Nardino Pellegrini. He's the only Italian, as far as I know, who's located in the old Adaminabi Cemetery. The gravestone is a very simple one. It's got a gravestone with an engraving, which you can no longer read because, let's say, the colouring or the paint has decayed. The recess of the lettering is there. And the top had caved in. I wondered again about, he was from Pitigliano in Toscana. So same question, you know, like, has any of his family ever been able to pay their respects to him?
Well, do they even know? Is another,
well, the current relatives, yeah, I don't know what they know, but at the time someone would have known,
yeah,
that, you know, that their son had died, you know, presuming they did have actual relatives, because some of these young men, at least one parent was not alive at the time that they came out, but you would assume that they would have at least had siblings in Italy or something like that. So that's when I was looking at them, saying, I'd gone from what to me seemed like an effort to research these four men for, because I don't operate in this space. I don't write history or, you know, anything like this. And so last year was the 75th anniversary of the Snowy Scheme. And for the first time, I went to one of their events. And on this particular occasion, the theme was the workers, let's honour the workers. And a little publication they circulated, to their credit, was a list of all of the names of the people who died. So after the event, I went and had a look at a couple of things to do with the scheme. And I went back to the cemetery. And I paid a bit more attention, and because I used to do a lot of technical drawing in my work, I decided I would just map out where these Italians were in this cemetery, all in a group together, but not absolutely just them. There's a few other. So I just took a note of the names that were there and decided that I would research more of them with a goal to do all of the Italians. Someone in Cuma had volunteered to help by looking at the old newspaper articles and send them to me. And then I looked online on what's called Trove, where digitised newspaper articles are held. And I looked at the New South Wales records for inquests, probate and deceased estates documents, and I looked on the National Archives for their migration documents. Alien registration, migrant selection documents was another, and I looked at Bongilla for any that had a Bongilla card. I decided that then I would try and do this aspect with a goal to connecting with any relatives that I could and share with them the documents that I had obtained, on the basis that it was eye-opening for me to read for myself the inquest report and give relatives likewise the opportunity to say, well, you've probably heard stories in your family about, which is most likely an uncle, and if you like, you can actually read the documents and know for yourself. So that's my current mission, is to achieve that. And to date, I've established contact with, say, 8 or 9 of those 29.
Are these people who are in Australia and also in Italy?
Yes, yeah. Both, right? So yeah. So I know that some had connections in Australia because their migration documents indicate that, but I suspect that many others didn't. So I believe that their relatives will be some here. They still would have some relatives in Italy, but others exclusively have relatives in Italy. So it's very gratifying for me, for those who are willing, because there's a couple have been reticent about taking it any further and wanting to learn more, which I respect, it's their right. Beyond that, I think that it's an important story to revisit.
We've been listening to part one of an interview I did with Tony Guselli about his research on the Italian men who died in industrial accidents working on the construction of the Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme. We'll be sharing the names and details, including photos of these men, along with Tony's contact details on our show notes, and encourage any listeners who may be related to or know these men or have a connection to the Snowy scheme to reach out. Part 2, the second half of this interview, will be broadcast next week. Tony has recommended we play a song called The Cooma Cavaliers by The Settlers. This song was written by Irishman Ulick O'Boyle and features on their album Songs of the Snowy Mountains.
Ludwig will now sing a great new Australian ballad. 1, 2, 3. From Jindabyne Tunnel and Round Island Bend, we boys go to Cooma, our money to spend, and we'll buy yours one beer there if you happen to see. For Italians, 3 Germans, 2 Yugoslavs and me. Now we may not be diggers, but we'll have you know, we're digging the tunnels up here in the snow. It's dark in that tunnel and the work she is rough. By the time it hits payday, we all have enough. So we rush into Cooma to have us one spree.
4 miners, 3 fitters, 2 chippies and me.
Come in, Mikhailovich.
We pull up in Sharp Street by the Alpine Hotel. If you've been to Cooma, you know this place well. And before we get inside, our order ring out.
4 vinos, 3 schnapses, 2 slivovitz, 1 stout.
Sing up, Giuseppe.
Well, I guess we got the noisy, don't a harm did we mean. Singing Oh Sol Mio and Lily Marlene. Some Aussies went to Crooka cause they didn't agree.
With 4 singing, 3 marching, 2 dancing and me. Now we may not be diggers, but we'll have you know, we're digging your tunnels up here in the snow.
The barman stood up then with a snarl on his face. He said,
you Europeans, you're a flipping disgrace. Stop drinking those queer drinks if you want to stop here. Become integrated, drink our Aussie beer.
So we switched on to schooners and to the bar's cheers. Sang Waltzing Matilda and Clip Gold Shears. For hours and hours without any cease, till the sudden arrival of the Cooma police.
Now we may not be diggers, but we'll have you know, we're regular swiggers up here in the snow.
In a furious moment, the whole bar was cleared, and no sign remained of those Aussies that cheered. So the coppers locked up, saying unfair, you'll agree.
4 Italians, 3 Germans, 2 Yugoslavs and me.
Now we're back in that tunnel as broke as can be, for it cost us a fortune to bail ourselves free. But before you start laughing, let me make it clear, it was worth it, Australia, for the sake of your beer. For we may not be diggers, but we'll have you know, we dig digger beer up here in the snow.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.